I'd like to call the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform and Correction Subcommittee to order. I believe we have a quorum. First of all, probably should start by turning on the microphone.
I think it's on.
No, it's got to be blue according to, right, Javier?
We're good?
Okay. I will start by recognizing Chair Mariani.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a first for us. We're the Subcommittee on Corrections and the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform is convening together. I suspect, or I know, we're going to do that a few more times, including upcoming tour that we're going to be doing at Stillwater. And I believe probably our first, historically perhaps, the first time that's happened in state history. So we'll have the historians double check that, but we think that's correct. Let me just very quickly say that I'm real pleased to be able to welcome our new commissioner for public safety, Commissioner Paul Schnell, and for a number of reasons. One, because Officer Schnell policed my community back in the day. And there's plenty of residents in our community who still recall your presence there and your fine work with us as well. And then also, and much more to on point for today's discussion, and quite frankly, Mr. Chair, what I hope will be the strong focus of this committee and subcommittee, as well as other committees in the House, is to really emphasize the holistic approach to public safety so that public safety really becomes synonymous with community well-being, with community safety, with building strong communities and sustaining them over time. And I think there's plenty of experience and evidence that's emerging across our nation at the local level where you don't have to compromise one for the other. Where you can have publicly safe communities where your loved ones can be freely involved, and one where we're building community with those who make mistakes, pay their price, and want to be part of whole and healthy communities. And so I'm hoping that that will guide much of our values and principles in today's conversation, but also, quite frankly, as we go forward through the rest of this legislative session. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for arranging for this joint hearing, and I look forward to today's testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to talk real briefly about a theme that we're developing for both corrections committees, and that's we want people to come home safely. Of course, we've had some horrendous problems this year that we do not want to see repeated, and we will be dealing with the safety and security of the institutions. But without safety and security in institutions, we really can't accomplish our other goals. Adequate programming, meaningful job training, improvements in the education system, so that when our residents are leaving, they're going home safely too, and also with some hope. And like I said, we're going to deal first and foremost with safety and security, but with an eye on looking how we can improve things. The ultimate goal for this committee will be to reduce the number of people that are in prison. It's gotten horrendously expensive on the one hand, but simply it's the right thing to do. So with that, I will, well, as Chair Mariani mentioned, we're having the tour on Friday. If you want to go, I would really encourage you to sign up so we have some idea about how many people want to attend on Friday. Right now, I think we have two people that have gone ahead and signed up. I'll say that I'm on that list now, too. I haven't done it either. I'm going to be there. But with that, I'm going to turn it over to the Department of Corrections. Commissioner Schnell, we are very excited about having Commissioner Schnell on board. In our preliminary talks, I think we're all working in the same direction. So Commissioner Snell.
Thank you, chairs and committee members. It is a tremendous honor for me to be able to sit in this chair. I've had the pleasure of meeting many of you and testifying before many of you in my previous work in policing. This is a bit like coming home for me. I started my career as a social work intern at the University of St. Thomas, and my first internship was in a halfway house working with adult male offenders. I spent almost 10 years working in corrections prior to making the flip over to law enforcement, and spent about the past 25 plus years working in that capacity in a variety of departments. In the short time since the announcement by Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, I've had an incredible opportunity to talk with a wide variety of the staff at the Minnesota Department of Corrections. Many of them I knew, including the Deputy Commissioner Solheider on my left, who I remember being much younger from years ago. And so it's nice to be able to come back and begin to work with these people. And I think in light of the things that have happened in the past 6 months in our facilities, the deaths of Officer Gom and Officer Parisi, for me, this is a critical time. It's something that I understand through a different but connected experience and the losing a colleague in the line of duty as the folks in the Department of Corrections have experienced. The impact of that is certainly for the Gump family and for the immediate coworkers is profound. But these incidents have incredible impact on organizations. And I'm really honored to be in a position to call all the 4,300 members of Minnesota's Department of Corrections, now my colleagues. I look forward to having the opportunity to speak to the memory and sacrifice of these correctional officers who I think were doing critical work that's oftentimes forgotten by members of the community. And they paid a profound price, but one that I think is important to the safety and well-being of our communities going forward. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I look forward to working with you, and I look forward to ultimately bringing together the collective of the Department of Corrections, members of our community, non-governmental organizations, in a way that ultimately results in the people that are inside of our prisons and being supervised on probation across our state ultimately do better. They come back and become wholly engaged in our communities and become pro-social, regular neighbors, which is at the end of the day what we all want. So with that, chairs and committee members, I'd like to, I'll start the launch of giving you the overview. I'm going to start, and then I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues here who represent both field services and the facilities side divisions of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. So as I mentioned earlier, Minnesota Department of Corrections is a large organization, 4,300 staff. About 80% of the employees of the Minnesota Department of Corrections are working in the facilities side, the facilities division. Of the department. The priorities are simply to provide for the safety and security and fewer assaults and injuries to our staff. And ultimately, we need to drive down. We have the goal of driving down prison population through a combination of education, treatment, evidence-based programming for those that are involved. And obviously, one of the things that becomes key and really critical is the fact that we have to give emphasis and attention to prevention as well. Right now, there is over 105,000 offenders on probation in the state of Minnesota. The committee yesterday spent some time, at least preliminary discussions, about probation in Minnesota with more to come. We are just shy of 10,000 people that are sitting in our prisons today or are involved, engaged in our prisons. These are made up of people who are sentenced directly into court. They may also be probation violators, people who did not abide by the conditions as established by the court, or release violators, those that have been subjected to a release, which we'll talk a bit more about later. And ultimately, about 6,500 people are on supervised release status. In some states, that would be known as parole. So how does that divide out? In Minnesota, we have a determinate sentencing system, in which two-thirds of an offender's sentence is spent in incarceration, and in this case, in prison. We know that, and the remaining one-third of that time is really focused on supervised release. There can be some provisions whereby there can be an extension on supervised release, but for the most part, it's going to be one-third of their sentence is going to be spent on supervised release to an agent in the community. This becomes, I think, critically important in that we have to recognize that 95% of these people, over 7,000 people, bigger than many of the communities in Minnesota, are going to come back to our communities. They're going to be neighbors of ours, and it is in our collective best interest to not only keep them safe and engaged while they are in the facility, but it becomes our collective best interest for them to ultimately walk out of those facilities better off than they were when they came in. And that is the goal of our department. 78% of those offenders, these offenders do have some previous violent convictions in their background. About 54% of the offenders are in prison, serving prison time for person-based offenses. So assault, sexual assault, those sorts of crimes. And then ultimately, when we look at this, we know that when we look at at who's in our facilities, that some of them have 10 prior criminal convictions, a good percentage of them have four priors. So when we look at the prior criminal, if that's general, it could be misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, or felony. Four is really felony only. So that's the distinction. With that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague here to introduce himself and then to walk us through the facilities.
Committee chairs, committee members, I'm Bruce Reiser. I'm the deputy commissioner of the facilities division, and I'll discuss the next few slides that we have here. We have 10 correctional facilities at 11 different locations. The custody level breakout is we have one maximum custody, which is Oak Park Heights, 3 level 4, which we call close custody, which are at Stillwater, St. Cloud, and Rust City. Level 3s, which are medium security, we have Moose Lake, Lionel Lakes, and Faribault. 2 CIP programs, Challenge Incarceration Program, which is a boot camp type setting with COG skills and CD type training. And that's at Willow River, and then one way up in northern Minnesota in Togo. And the female facility, which is at Shakopee. And that's kind of a unique facility because it covers all custody levels from a minimum all the way to max custody, and they're all housed in the one facility. We also have minimum units that are attached to Stillwater, Faribault, Lionel Lakes, and the Red Wing facilities. So, and Red Wing is our only juvenile facility. We have about a population of any given time between the high 70s to the high 80s, so someplace in that range. If you look at the PowerPoint, it kind of talks about little physical plant issues because we're always asking for additional funding for physical plant issues, and you can see by the dates on a lot of these facilities, they're not new facilities by any means. We pretty regularly ask for substantial asset preservation and different funding to help us keep the facilities up and operational, because if you don't have a good physical plant, it's very difficult to maintain good security. Capacity levels are also on the PowerPoint. We got some other, the next slide. Minnesota adult prison population, it's over the last 10 years. And as you can see, as in 2015, 16, and 17, our population was fairly stable. 2018, our population has dropped to about 9,849 beds. And our projection for the next 2 years is relatively flat. So our projections are that that population will remain fairly consistent. When we were at over 10,000, we had to rent beds from the jail facilities. And so at one point in time in the last 3 years, we were renting up to 500 beds in jails to act as that pressure relief valve for the number of offenders that we had in our system. But since our population has come down, that number, we've been reducing the number of offenders we're keeping in county jails. And right now, the number fluctuates between 130 and 140. So it's been good. The jail setting works very well, but it's a different environment than it works very well for us as a pressure relief valve, Chair Considine. It's not the best way to operate, but it helped us get over the hump, and hopefully the numbers will continue on the same path, which alleviates some of those issues.
I'm sorry about shaking my head when you were saying that. It's just we had a contract with Stillwater that didn't work out real well when I was working.
We have, you know, the next diagram shows our offender inmate profile, how it's broke down. As the commissioner said, you know, about 53.2% of our offenders that are incarcerated are person offenders. Drug offenders is the next largest category, property offenders, and then the others.
Committee members, the chairs and committee members, I can just add one thing. I think when we begin to look at some of the drive and when we look at some of these numbers, and I think at some point in time it will be helpful to look at things like the felony DWI laws in terms of impact, as well as some of the mandatory minimums on weapons-related offenses do become a factor in terms of looking at population growth over time.
Excuse me, Commissioner. We have a question. And I'm sorry, I should have recognized him at the beginning. Chair Lesh is also going to be very involved in this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, only if I have to. My question relates to weapons. So 6.9% weapons, Commissioner, that's exclusive. That's simply weapons possession, right? You get caught with it and because, I mean, otherwise it'd be a person offender, right?
Correct, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, yeah, this really speaks to if it's an assault, it would really be more that it's going to be more of the assault offense. The weapons, this weapon stuff really relates more to the establishment of some of the mandatory minimums around weapon possession by ineligible persons.
Got it.
Felons.
Thank you.
Okay, we have one more question. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Chairs. I just have a question about the population and your projections. You're projecting a lower population in the future. I'm wondering how you come up with that number.
Chairs and Commissioner, Representative Christensen, rather, I would just say that we'll get to that point. We'll talk about some of the ways in which we're seeing population fluctuation and what we think are some of the kind of low-hanging fruit, perhaps, that we might be able to begin to look at to address some of those issues and speak to that more clearly.
Chairs, committee members, providing security is, of course, you know, and safety is what we do as corrections. And in addition to that, the programming of offenders to try to assist them in developing marketable skills when they get out so they don't come back to prison. But we, as Chair Considine said, we can't do that unless the facilities are safe. And a part of that is, you know, our maintaining security and safety, you know, and it's a 24-hour day, 7-day week, holidays, evenings, midnights, business. It's not You know, it's not office hours. It's not a 8 to 4:30 job. It's 24/7. And so we depend on our security staff to address the security issues and to maintain a safe working environment 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And not only do we depend on our security staff to do that, we depend on all staff that works within the Department of Corrections to adhere to that same philosophy, because it's important that, you know, as an organization, we're all on the same page, and, you know, and we're all talking out of the same book. And so it's important that if you're a case manager or a nurse or a therapist or a maintenance person, you know, that we all have an obligation to ensure that it's a safe facility. And and that's our business, and we take that very seriously. We have an Office of Special Investigations, and it's broke down into a few different units. We have our Fugitive Apprehension Unit, which goes out, and they're law enforcement. They're peace officer certified. They apprehend the people that abscond from supervision. Right now, with level three sex offenders, the apprehension rate is 99.5% within 72 hours of the time that we're notified that they've taken off or they're not, you know, that they've not complied with the rules. So they are very proficient, you know, and it wouldn't be, we wouldn't be able to do that if it wouldn't also be that we depended on the assistance of local law enforcement. So we are really integrated with the local law enforcement community and work very, very closely together to go back and apprehend these guys to get them back under custody again. They also have a section of the a special investigations unit that works within our correctional facilities, and they do a lot of the information collection for us. They monitor phones, you know, any type of drug introduction, anything like that that jeopardizes the safety and security of the facility. That piece of our investigative unit of the Office of Special Investigations provides that information to us and to the management team so that we can get on top of that. Because, you know, drugs in a correctional facility is never a good thing. It's a monetary issue. People use it to trade and barter, and nothing good ever happens when that's the case. We have incident management teams. They are FEMA trained and certified. We have a regional team, a north and a south, very trained, very capable. Any type of crisis situation that we have in the department, we'll call out and we'll get these people trained, and we get them integrated into our facilities to assist with managing crisis situations. And so it's been very beneficial. They work with the state duty office, and you know, are involved with, again, it's not only IMT for Department of Corrections, it's also IMT for the state, and we share and our resources and services with other entities. We have canine officers in the facilities. They are very, very well received. It just takes a canine barking to calm a situation down very quickly, and it's surprising how fast that works, and you know, and just the presence kind of changes the atmosphere. So we are committed to our canine department and our canine officers, and you know, they're tested, they're qualified, they're certified. They go out and you know, do the different scenarios, and they actually have received a lot of awards because they are very, very good. Special operations teams, we have a few different special operations teams, and one is called SOG, Special Operations Group, and they're very highly trained individuals. They're trained in weapons, they're trained in cell entry, trained in chemicals, and they're made up of individuals from each facility. And so it's a very sought-after position. People interview for it, a lot of training, a lot of physical activity. And we also have SORT teams, which are more specific to the facility. So they're staff that are actually in the facility that are SORT trained, and it's just a little bit lower than the Special Operations Group. We also have hostage negotiation teams, again, that are trained and work together with our SORT and SOG teams, just in case we'd have a crisis situation where there'd be a hostage. And so we feel that it's imperative that, we are trained and very adept at responding to any of these critical crisis situations because, you know, it's all about safety and security and saving lives. And if we can do that, that's the most important thing. The crisis intervention team, we have crisis intervention training for staff, and it was originally developed in Memphis by law enforcement, and it was to deal with staff that, or not staff, people that have mental health issues. And so they're trained in how to manage and to interact with offenders that are in crisis situation and having mental health issues so that we don't have to use force to try to go and work with the offender. We'd rather sit and talk and have somebody come out peacefully and being able to rationalize. And so it's just better, a better environment for the offenders and better environment for the staff.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill has a question.
Thank you, Chair. Just to that point, as I was touring the facilities, you had a goal of 25% of your staff being CIT trained. How close to that goal are you right now?
I believe we're probably in the 20s, 22, 23. You know, with turnover, it's very difficult because you get people trained and then some leave, you know, and move around. And so the number fluctuates, but we are very adamant. And we usually have a couple training academies of 20 to 25 a year. So,
Chair and Representative O'Neill, if I can just add, I think right now one of the challenges has been our staffing levels being so low in general has made it really difficult to move people out to attend crisis intervention training.
Representative O'Neill, you got a follow-up?
Just a quick comment, because I actually met your daughter when I was touring, who is CIT trained, and she was wonderful explaining the program and how effective she is and how she has prevented so many different situations that could have turned violent. And I just thought I should point that out, that your daughter is CIT trained and was there at one of the facilities doing a great job.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. She's neglected to tell me about some of these things. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, I was actually going to bring this up after the next slide, but you bring up an important, you kind of answered my question I was going to ask about your, my understanding, sorry, I'm going to have to walk away from the microphone so I can see you. There we go. We'll just do that to answer. You're indicating that your staffing numbers are low. What are the challenges that you're seeing to fill those spots? What are some of the, and I don't need a whole overview, but what are some of the challenges that you're seeing to make sure that, because I think one of the concerns that we have when some of the incidents we've seen this last year is you know, are we helping those people that are, you know, doing their work there with proper staffing? So what are some of those challenges?
Chairs, Representative Miller, we will talk about that more, but I would just say quickly that we are looking at and exploring, and this we just left the meeting, in fact, with all the wardens, talking very specifically about some steps around recruitment, even looking at every option, scheduling, because ultimately there's not a single fix to this. We know that we need to bring up our staffing. That becomes essential. And I appreciate the question in part because one of the things that I think is important, some people have said, so why is, what is the security? What do the corrections officers do? And I think one of the things that oftentimes people may not understand about what happens inside a prison is nothing happens. Going to dinner, going to an education program, going to GED classes or treatment. None of those things happen without security to help, corrections officers to help make those moves, to move people from their units, their cell blocks, to those programs. Nothing. And I think that really becomes important in idle time, as any of us who are parents of teenagers or once were, know that idle time is not a good thing. And it's certainly the case in life generally, and it's really particularly, I think, challenging inside of correctional facilities. And so this becomes, I think what we begin to see, and we've talked a lot about, is that oftentimes we find ourselves in this kind of self-reinforcing cycle of we need to get people, we need to engage people in programming, but we have to have staff to move them and secure the programming sites. And then, you know, we have to have the bodies, and ultimately there's a whole range of issues around that, which this committee will talk more about here, and will certainly be the topic of considerable conversation as we go forward budget. And, but even operationally, we think that there may be some things that we at least want to explore and are having conversations across the facilities with the officers, with the unions, about how it is that we ultimately meet the immediate needs, because that's the reality of the situation for our officers.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. And Representative Miller, if I could just give one example. Recently, Oak Parks, I think for the first time in their history, had to cancel visiting. And frankly, I don't know of anything that infuriates the residents there more than to have some family member travel for hours to get there for a visit that they have been looking forward to and be told, we don't have enough staff to cover it today. That actually turns into a volatile situation rather quickly. The other things I appreciate, but when you start counseling visiting, you're going to have some real problems. If you would continue, thank you.
Committee chairs, members, this shows the number of assaults and the patterns that have occurred within the last, since fiscal year 13 to fiscal year 19. So as you can see, fiscal year 18 was not a good year at all regarding staff assaults, assaults of staff causing harm, assaults of staff with weapons, or assaults of staff with weapon causing harm. So it's been a very, very difficult year, and there could be a number of factors that are it's attributed to. But we continue to work on making our facility safer. If it's an assault that injures staff, we always refer it to the county. And so this half of fiscal year 19, we've referred 28 to the county for prosecution in the counties that the facility is located in. In 18, it was 55, and in fiscal year 17, it was 71 assaults that we've referred to the county for prosecution. So,
you took a break, so Representative Zerwas has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess to Commissioner Schnell, and congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
On the appointment, and best of luck. I think kind of looking at the numbers and following the press reports and talking with some of the employees there, it's clear that over the course of the last 2 years, something dramatically different has occurred, creating an environment in which the rate of assaults on staff climbed so dramatically. And I think, I know going back a few years, there was the Star Tribune expose on the use, and in some instances, I think, arguably, the misuse of solitary confinement in some instances, or at least the inability to document the reasons of the use of solitary confinement. I want to be very transparent in that the last several years, I tried with your predecessor to get data on the number of people in solitary confinement, the length of time that they were in solitary confinement, when those times were extended, and for what reasons, the underlying cause for being put in solitary, and then why, if extensions were made, why those individuals were extended. And quite honestly, 27 months later, I've got nothing as far as data from the department. And it's a real challenge especially being a policy person that's supposed to help figure out how to improve this and move forward. And so I think there's an opportunity with the new administration and you being new in role to improve that working relationship. And I look forward, Commissioner, to working with you. There was concerns expressed several years back about individuals that were spending 10, 12, 20, 30, or 40 months contiguously in solitary confinement. And then some cases, after 2-3 years in solitary confinement, their term expiring and being let directly out into the public after years of 23 hours a day isolation. So clearly setting folks up to fail. And so at that time when we had legislation that the former commissioner was not supportive of really at all and helped end, we were constantly told that the department was in the early stages of working with a consulting firm that had done some work in other states. And if my memory serves me, I think it was Colorado specifically, and perhaps Michigan. Colorado, I'm pretty sure of. Michigan, the states are rattling around in my head. I don't know if I have that one 100% right. But my understanding in talking to staff and kind of digging into this is instead of looking at legislation which asked for annual reporting of data back to the legislature and then benchmarks for keeping individuals in segregation that would have sign-offs by the commissioner or designee if someone's going to be held in segregation for longer than 90 days. Rather than complying with something like that, my understanding is, and I've been told kind of two versions of this, my understanding is that sometime in 2017, the use of solitary confinement or administrative seg was arbitrarily capped at 90 days. And so that a maximum time someone would spend in segregation was 90 days. In fact, even if an inmate assaulted an employee or a correctional officer, the max they would be held in seg is 90 days. Clearly, that's not at all what the previous Public Safety Committee had discussed. It's not in accordance to any legislation that had been introduced. And if that is in fact the case, it is a huge swing of the pendulum that some feel, some staff specifically feel, could be at the core of this huge uptake in 2017 and 2018 of not just assaults, but violent assaults on individuals. And so I guess I'm concerned really, Commissioner, in moving and legislating forward and not looking backwards under a previous administration. And so what I'm looking for is an opportunity for you to express to this committee your commitment to looking at policy changes to make sure that individuals that do in fact pose real harm to your employees are segregated from the population and that reasons for that segregation are documented. And I think as important as the other two, the data of that action is provided back to these committees and to legislative leaders. Can I have your commitment on that today, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zurawas, without a doubt, you can have my commitment on that. That was not just hearing that loud and clear from you. It was also certainly an expectation of the governor that would be something I would do. This is a tremendously complicated issue. I've just started to get into this, but I do believe that it is critical that this committee and certainly even the public have an awareness of how restrictive housing or segregation is used in response to incidents in the prison. I think as we've talked about and looked at what's happened, there is one of the things that becomes a little challenge with the numbers is some of the ways in which the count happened, and I don't want to minimize because these are real incidents involving real people. So I don't want to minimize that at all. At the same time, what we I think need to do is understand to what extent did one affect the other is a bit unclear. Number one, and number two, I do think that one of the challenges around the change in policy that did occur ultimately was, I think, some concerns about the lack of staffing to make that viable, to make that work, to make that make sense, and to provide adequate supports for people who were in restrictive housing because of conduct issues, in particular assault on staff. This is, I think, a critical issue. We, as a department, are focusing heavily on evidence-based practice from around the country and what we know is happening. We are looking at rolling out or having discussions with staff right now about how that would happen and when that can happen based upon the staffing realities that we have. And ultimately, there has to be accountability for assaults on staff, but we also have to recognize the impact and the harm that segregation can cause, because that too is contrary to our interests. So this is a challenging balancing act, but that is the work, and you do have a commitment that we will bring that information forward.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Zerwas, that may have been the longest question on record. If we could have the questions be a tad more succinct so that we can
I'm just here to help, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, and as you and I have talked about, is that program was implemented incorrectly, and there were some big problems, not so much with the program, but how it was implemented. And again, you and I have talked about the data, and that will be something that the committee is supportive of. But if we could keep our questions a little bit shorter in length, like I said, so we can get through the thing, that would be nice. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, Commissioner. It's good to see you. When I look at this chart, I begin to get alarmed, and I think that Representative Zerwas's comments show that there's a correlation, but not necessarily causation. And I think that we need to be careful when we look at this to actually understand what's happening. You know, the question of, restrictive housing was brought up, but if I look, there also seems to be more weapons. And so there's something else going on, and I just hope that as you move forward and you do some analysis, that you understand that, you know, some things aren't going to really be measurable, and just because something's measurable doesn't mean it's going to be the cause. So I hope that in addition to the commitment that you gave to Representative Zerwas and the committee, that you're committed to really trying to dig underneath what this is. And, you know, I'd like to just make a comment, if I can, Mr. Chair, really quickly, that, you know, I think some changes to the sentencing guidelines and some of the other things that we're doing about reduction of recidivism and things has had an impact on the population of residents that are being incarcerated. And I hope that we will continue to look at that, because ultimately, you know, you can not hire any more staff, but if you reduce the population by 1,000, in the prison system, that then impacts that ratio. So I think we need to look at not just either or, but and then what, and I think we can continue to make some progress. But, you know, clearly there are some issues around safety for those individuals inside, and not just for those that work, but, you know, the residents that are locked up as well. There are safety concerns for them as well. So I appreciate your time.
And a comment to follow Representative Dean is I wish you would have included the assaults on residents. From years past where I have been looking at these, it's there's significantly more assaults on residents, in part just because of proximity. But when we're talking about safety and security, it is the residents also that we are concerned about, and we want them to go home safely also. Representative Edelson, you're next.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, thank you for being here and all of your work. In terms of these assaults that are taking place, I guess I'm wondering about the larger picture and what it looks like after an assault takes place in a prison. After an assault takes place, what happens to programming? What happens, or do you see systematically more assault happen to officers where in a prison where an assault has already taken place? I would like data like that. I think it would be good to see what are the results of assaults after they take place in a prison, and what are the longer impacts that are that you're seeing?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we can absolutely do that. I think we are also just trying to get a better sense of exactly what some of the motives are. And, you know, we're learning some things about that. And in fact, on Sunday, I spent some time up in St. Cloud just visiting with staff and meeting some of the inmates. And during the course of that, there was a staff assault not that long ago, within the last month or so. Somebody was, one of the staff was hit with a meal tray. And really, I think some of the motivation around that was an attempt by a person to be moved to a different facility. And so motivations can be run across the board. But we also want to look at, are there institutional practices that ultimately increase the likelihood of problems? And I think to your point, reducing and programming or availability or increasing idle time certainly has an impact. Mr. Chair, to your comment, I will just say that when we meet next Wednesday, we will definitely cover and talk about the assaults on staff, or on inmate-to-inmate assaults.
Thank you. I would appreciate that. Let's try to get back on track. Representative O'Neill has another quick question.
I do, and it is on track. I thought it would be important for you to say after an assault happens on staff particularly, you actually had started to allude to that, the fact that maybe somebody wants to move to a different facility. And just since we're a brand new committee with lots of new members, maybe you could just say, explain a little bit about, say, if you're at St. Cloud, which is sort of entry, that's where they all start, compare that to Oak Park Heights, which is our maximum, and what does it take? So what are we doing with these folks if they have assaulted staff or assaulted an inmate? Where do they go? They don't always just go into solitary in that particular facility, but they might get moved to a higher security facility, and you sort of take it up to another level and another level. I think that might be helpful for them to understand as well.
Committee Chair and members, it depends on the severity of the assault. If there's no significant injury to staff, we may keep that offender in a particular facility if it's an appropriate custody level, because when an offender does any type of behavior, their custody points could get adjusted, which would move them up to a higher custody level. So if offender assaults a staff, they're going to end up at Oak Park Heights, and they'll end up in restrictive housing at Oak Park Heights, and they'll end up working through our step-down management program that we have in place right now at Oak Park Heights, which is actually has worked some of the bugs out, and it is, I think, more well received than we initially, the initial implementation by the security staff there. And through that process, the offenders receive COG skills training throughout the step down process. And as they show positive behavior, we work them down into a less restrictive environment to try to get them, I guess not to be perfect citizens, but to be better offenders and be less of a risk. So depending on the severity of the incident that occurs, that results in where they're going to end up in our system. Everybody comes in through St. Cloud. We review the file. We look at what they came in for. We assign them custody points. And then based on what their infraction was or their charge coming into prison, they could go right from St. Cloud to Oak Park Heights if it's a horrendous crime that they committed, or if it's a minor type issue, they could end up going to a level three facility. We look at their needs. If it looks like it's been a chemical dependency issue all along, we'll get them to Lionel Lakes where they can get into a chemical dependency program. If they come in and they don't have any viable job skills, maybe we'll get them to a Faribault Correctional Facility where they have education, vocational programming. You know, so we try to match our facility, what we offer in the facilities to the needs of the offenders, you know, so that when they come in, we're starting to work with them to make them better when they leave rather than waiting till they leave. And then all of a sudden we're scrambling and they say, oh, gosh, this person doesn't have any job skills. Too bad. It's been 5 years and we didn't do anything. And that's not how we operate. So so that's just a brief explanation.
And Mr. Chair, just a quick poll. So this is why it's so important to go to Stillwater, but it's also important to go and see all of the prisons if you're going to be on the Corrections Committee, because there is a vast difference between going to Shakopee, going to Oak Park Heights, going to Lino. I mean, they are complete, at Stillwater, they're completely different fields and prisons and, you know, kind of where they're allowed to move. And you have to see it for yourself. You can't even understand it until you actually are there and walk through it and see it. But, you know, that's why I wanted to point that out, is that if there is an assault that happens, there's more than just restrictive housing that can happen, and they can be moved to, like you said, Oak Park Heights, which is quiet and movement is very limited. And it's more of a very, it's kind of its own solitary all on its own. So anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. And for those who don't know, I believe Representative O'Neill has visited 10 out of 11. So that's admirable. I haven't been to that many. Let's try to get back on track with the presentation, actually. So.
Committee Chair, committee members, you know, we're...
I'm sorry. Chair Lesch has a question. One moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was related to Representative Zerwas's earlier line of questioning regarding the lack of data. And I appreciated, Commissioner, you know, you understand the buck stops here, which is good. But I think probably maybe it's the two gentlemen flanking you that might have an explanation as to the legal basis under which that the data was withheld. Can either of you gentlemen explain why the data on that request that Representative Zerwas had was withheld?
Committee Chair, committee members, I can make up all kinds of excuses, I guess, but our comms system, our offender information system does not do a good job tracking disciplinary offenses. You know, I'm getting into the weeds, but we track it by housing assignment. And so we could have an offender that has done a period of time in segregation or restrictive housing, had some problems. We moved him to the mental health unit for 2, 3, 4 months. And then all of a sudden he moved back to our restrictive housing unit after he was stabilized again. And so, you know, from our perspective, when we pull it up on comms, it says that he's been in segregation for, you know, 40 months, when in actuality he had a break in the middle of the sentence. And so do you count that as segregation sentence? Do you say, no, he was did this much time and then this much time on the end and then in the middle? But our systems doesn't distinguish that. And so there were some problems with our systems that we are working on and we're rectifying right now. So we should be able to provide you with accurate information in the forthcoming when you request it. So I that's the best I got for you.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up on Representative O'Neill's questions on housing. I'm just wondering if criminal history scores factor into where an inmate is assigned.
Committee Chair, committee members, yes, it does.
Without further ado, we can return to the presentation. Thank you.
Committee Chair, committee members, security improvements are very important. We continue to look at our systems and look at ways we can upgrade technology, security improvements. At a few facilities, our fence systems are at the point where they had to be replaced. So our fence protection systems at the facilities, which are alarms that go off if an offender tries to breach the fence. We've replaced those phone systems. In Moose Lake, we're replacing our master control area, which houses all the security systems for the unit. Door controls right now, we have a facility at Faribault that our door control system for the department or for the facility is running on Windows XP, which is obsolete and has been obsolete for a long time. And so we've been able to kind of mothball some computers and we pull them out when we have to. But, you know, that's another system that we're getting replaced. So, and then, of course, you know, the bonding last year taking care of the security nightmare at St. Cloud with the intake center that's there right now. And so that's going to be a wonderful addition to the department and make a much, much safer work environment for those staff that work in that area. Cameras, we're always looking at cameras. We're always trying to increase the numbers. We're, you know, switching a lot of them already from analog to digital. So that is an ongoing request and an ongoing funding issue. So we've done that. Reduced double bunking. With our reduction in population, we have had the opportunity to reduce double bunking at Stillwater by 65 beds, which is critical to the safety and security. They have another 62 beds that are double bunked that we will be taking a good hard look at and trying to reduce the population. It was never constructed to house, have shared or double bunks at Stillwater. The cells are extremely small, and when you go on the tour, you will see it. And so I think one of the better things that we can do for security is if a facility was constructed for single bunks, let's have single bunks and not double them up, because it just makes it very, very difficult to manage. Tool control, after the incident happened, we evaluated our tool control process. We looked at Connecticut, South Dakota, Washington State, North Carolina, Virginia. We analyzed and looked at their tool control policies, looked at ours, and did an audit at all the facilities to remove unnecessary tools from offender access. So that has went very well. But the difficult thing with some of this is that there's not very many occupations or industries that are out there that you don't need tools. And so how do you train offenders in carpentry and different vocational programming or you know, our maintenance staff or our industry if you don't have any tools available? So it's always a balance as to safety, security, and what type of tools that we allow to accomplish tasks that have to be accomplished. We also reviewed our offender work assignment at the higher custody levels. We took a look at made some new criteria. Offenders have to be a year seg free, 10 years no staff assaults, 3 year no weapons, 3 year no escape attempts, 3 years no visiting infractions for smuggling. And so we've assigned those criteria to specific jobs that like in the kitchen where they're, you know, they're using knives that are tethered or other types of tools like that. So we take a harder look at what offenders we have working where and the criteria that that we've established to allow them to work in those positions.
All right, Chair, committee members, I'm just going to talk really briefly around some of the things that we're doing relative to best practices, which obviously also I think is important. And the word gets kicked around a lot. But I want to be really clear about that we're distinguishing this evidence-based practice from the notion of what would be oftentimes referred to as best practices or just colloquially what works. Ultimately, when we talk about this, we're really looking at what's objective, the things that we can see, we can observe, and can be seen by others. It's replicable, so it can be repeated using the same methods and achieving the same outcomes. And then ultimately generalizable across a variety of settings with similar outcomes. We're doing this in our case management, in both in our facilities and even doing things like motivational interviewing, which is, for instance, an evidence-based practice that can be used by even correctional officers, which is around how do we more deeply engage the inmates to become a part of creating a more positive milieu, or more positive environment. When we bring people in, there's a heavy emphasis on looking at, and I think this was talked a little bit about in the intake process, is what is the needs that an offender has, what are the risks that they pose, and then what are they going to be most likely responsive to in terms of interventions. And the key to this becomes the ways in which we support and encourage and motivate them to become engaged in change, and then ultimately use a variety of proven interventions that address the criminogenic needs of the offenders. Some of the next slide, I think, just gives you a sense of where some of the evidence-based programming and what the return on investment is. And I want to be really clear about something, that when we're talking about costs, we're talking the first line, the bold line, we're talking about not cost savings, but cost avoided. That ultimately, that if you look at chemical dependency treatment, providing that to our inmates results in 17% fewer rearrests, 21% reconvictions, a reduction in reconvictions, and 25% reduction in reincarceration. And so I think being committed to wanting to address the needs of these offenders, I think speaks to the fact that we need workforce, obviously, Minnesota and really across our nation. And this has been, I think, one of the areas that has been untapped. And we want them to come back into our communities and be successful, be proactively and pro-socially engaged. The next slide, we'll just talk just briefly about healthcare costs. And we bring this up as a challenge to us. Obviously, from a constitutional perspective, we provide the full range of...
Mr. Commissioner?
Yes.
Representative O'Neill has a question.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Back on your previous slide when you talked about treatment, there's something missing, which is the Prison Fellowship Program, which has a reduction of 40%, which is high. It's much higher than, well, I guess there's one employee, 55%, but you missed that. And I think that's really important to point out that it is a part of a chemical dependency treatment program, but it's very specialized, but they have a 40% reduction. And I just wanted to point that out, that that was missing on your slide.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner O'Neill, I think we do know that there's a variety of programs that achieve an array. And I think the more support the fellowship has been one of the places where offenders ultimately get higher levels of support that ultimately drives some of the improvement in the numbers. So just back on the notion of healthcare, these are challenges that you all face in profound ways in doing the business of policymaking for our state. But these realities, I think, are affecting us in significant ways. The cost, pharmaceuticals, infectious diseases. One of the things that's not on this list that I think is profound is the mental health realities of a high number of the people in our prisons. I know that you all as policymakers are hearing this from every front, education, law enforcement, corrections, human services. But this is an incredibly massive problem. And I think you walk into a unit, in Oak Park Heights, and you see some of the people that we have incarcerated that are that have really profound, serious, and persistent chronic mental illnesses. And I think as a society, as a community, while they did something to get there, the question becomes, is this the best place for them?
Mr. Commissioner, Representative Edelson has a question.
Just making sure everybody knows freshmen ask questions. All right. Thank you, Commissioner. So mental health is my background, and, of course, I want you to elaborate a little bit more about what your programming looks like in the prisons, because you do have a real opportunity to rehabilitate, and I'm curious what that looks like for you.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to make a very broad. We have people from Health Services here who could answer that really specifically. But there is the full range. We provide psychiatric services, obviously the full range of kind of medical interventions, pharmaceutical interventions, and psychotherapy in the prisons. And that's based, again, on what the needs that have been evaluated are. One of the challenges I think that we see along the continuum is many of the people that are coming into our prisons understandably have a whole range of needs. Oftentimes it's not one, but a range. And then the question becomes, depending upon how long they're going to be there, what they can access, how deeply engaged we can go with them because of the amount of time they're going to be there. And again, trying to also make sure that they have a GED or that they have that parenting class before they leave and get back in the community. So there is a lot of balancing that I think goes on in that. And certainly, if you have more specific questions, there are people here who can probably answer that in far more detail than I.
I would love them to follow up with me after this committee meeting. Thank you.
We can definitely do that. We'll talk just really briefly about educational programming, and then we'll get to the field services here. So, from an education standpoint, one of the things that happens when an offender comes into the prison for the first time, they look at education. If they do not have a GED or a high school diploma, that becomes a top priority. We know that's necessary. It's really needed. And so that really becomes where a lot of the work gets done. I had the incredible opportunity of spending some time in Faribault just about a week and a half ago for graduation. And it's really incredible to see many of these offenders who graduate from these programs and for the first time experience some level of success. We believe that education is one of the areas that that we can and should ultimately invest more in once we're able to provide that programming because of the reduction in recidivism. And there are some incredible examples from around our country of successes that have happened. But again, we need to make sure we have the staff in order to do that. You can see that this gives you a sense of the numbers of graduates. We do have 31 that had graduated with an associate degree, and there was a number of them when I attended in Faribault, as well as a really unique kind of electronics program that when these inmates get released, would put them into the jobs that would typically pay in the $25 to $30 an hour range. So there are some incredible opportunities here, and that's done in partnership with one of the local community colleges. And I think it's an area of incredibly high need for our state. So there are some opportunities here to meet mutual objectives. And then lastly, just I'm going to talk chemical dependency treatment here is, we see that a high number of these folks coming in with chemical dependency. That's not a surprise to any of us. We have about 1,000 of our beds are treatment focused. We know that ultimately this does become, again, a huge return on investment. For every dollar we spend, it's the return on investment is about $6.50. So doing treatment and providing a good chemical dependency treatment program and intervention and making sure they have that support when they come out is a true benefit.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Solhide, Deputy Commissioner of the Community Services Division at the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to talk a little bit about community supervision. As you can see by the first slide here, offenders spend approximately one-third of their sentence on supervision in the community, so two-thirds incarceration, one-third on supervision in the community. There are some nuances to that, which we won't go into, but essentially that's the typical stay for an offender. The next slide here talks about Minnesota. We rely heavily on community supervision. As you saw earlier, we have about 105,000 people on probation in the community, and we have about another 7,000 people who are on supervised release. They've come to prison and have been back, released back into the community or under supervision. I think the committee heard yesterday from Kelly Mitchell on in the Robina Institute, who talked about Minnesota having, typically we have the third or fourth lowest incarceration rate in the country, but we are about 13th or so on the community supervision side. So that essentially, when you look at other states, is kind of a trade-off. Probation is an alternative to incarceration for the courts, and we use it pretty effectively here in Minnesota. A couple of other things to think about with community supervision, that $105,000 is all community supervision on probation, both felons, adult misdemeanors, and juveniles. The felons comprise about $45,000 of that number on community supervision. The Community Services Division also assists in transition from prison to community. We have transition centers in all of our facilities. A number of the services that our folks provide, our transition coordinators, they coordinate getting offenders their identification prior to release from prison so that when they're walking out the door, they have social security cards, driver's license, if appropriate, or driver's ID, non-driver's ID, birth certificates. We work extensively with them to get them set up with those documents prior to releasing from prison. We require pre-release classes for we get the majority of our offenders into pre-release classes prior to being released from prison. And a lot of the curriculum focuses on life under supervision, how do you access resources, how do you get connected with resources in the community, and also how do you support yourself once you're released from prison and remain compliant while under supervision. We have integrated case managers in our facilities, and they look at specifically those high-risk offenders. That's an area that we're continuing to expand, and what that amounts to is taking the highest-risk offenders and reducing the caseloads for case managers who are working specifically with those offenders to ensure that we're getting them connected with services and programs while they're in prison and as they transition back into the community. Another function in our division is our Risk Assessment Community Notification Unit. The RACN unit essentially assigns risk levels to predatory offenders as they're releasing from prison. Many of these offenders obviously end up on our intensive supervised release when they're out in the community based upon their level of risk. On any given day, we have probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 1,300 offenders on intensive supervised release in the community. They also assist local law enforcement with community notification. So when you hear about essentially a level three offender releasing into the community and there is broad-based community notification, Our unit puts together the packet for law enforcement that provides them with all the information on this offender, and they determine what level of notification that they are going to provide to the community. Those packets of information are also put together for our OSI, our Special Investigations Unit, and that also contributes to some of that quick apprehension for those level three offenders when they leave, because they put an entire packet together of all the visitors they've had, phone numbers that they've contacted, any information that we glean while they're incarcerated goes to the Office of Special Investigations so that if a warrant is issued, they have a full packet of information to start to look, where do we look for this offender? How many visitors have they had in the last month and where are they likely to go? So that really aids in that apprehension process. We inspect and license and approve county jail facilities, adult halfway houses, some group homes, and juvenile facilities throughout the state. Our inspection and enforcement unit has regulatory responsibilities over about 213 facilities statewide, and we also certify out-of-state juvenile facilities. If juveniles are being placed in facilities in other states, our inspection and enforcement unit goes to those states and conducts inspections to ensure that they meet the same standards or similar standards to Minnesota facilities. Another unit within the Community Services Division provides victim notification and restorative justice services. That's a big part of what we do. There are approximately 9,000 to 10,000 people who have registered for notification against offenders within our prison system. So if an offender is going to move or change custody classification, as example, those individuals can receive notification that the offender is, as example, moving from Oak Park Heights to a medium custody facility. We also assist with restorative justice programming and services both in the facilities for offenders, opportunities for them to participate, victim-offender dialogue is one example, apology letters and apology letter bank for victims. And then we also do similar things in the community with our offenders under supervision, and we also have the sentencing to service program, which is really about paying back and giving back to the community through offenders working on community service projects. The other thing that we wanted to talk about here was the three delivery systems. I know we're going to get into that. That's one of the questions that the committee has. So I'll just give a very brief overview. You hear about three delivery systems, and folks often ask why. Well, I won't get into all of the historical perspective here, but essentially the Department of Corrections, we provide felony supervision to adults, adult felon supervision in 53 counties of the state. In 28 of those counties, we also supervise juvenile and adult misdemeanors that are on probation, and that is at the request of the county. In 75 counties, we provide for intensive supervised release, and statewide, we provide for supervision of offenders who are coming through the boot camp program or the challenge incarceration program. There are the Community Corrections Act counties. That was initiated back in the 1970s. That allowed for counties who were of a certain size, 30,000 or more, or a group of counties, could engage in providing all of the correctional supervision in their community. So counties such as Hennepin, Ramsey, Anoka, Dakota, there are 34 counties. They make up 21 jurisdictions, essentially, across the state. The map that's up there and the one in your handout kind of gives you an indication of where those counties are. They provide for all of the probation and supervised release, and in 12 of those counties, they provide for intensive supervised release supervision as well. And then lastly, we have the county probation offices, or what we call CPO counties. Those are 25 counties, and they reside within those 53 counties that the DOC operates, and we collaborate with them. They provide supervision to the juveniles and adult misdemeanors who are on probation in those counties. Just some of the things that we do and how we partner with the community on supervision. We contract with community-based halfway houses. They provide case management and transition services for offenders who are releasing from prison. There are just over a dozen halfway houses, the majority located in the metro area, but there's one in Rochester, one in Duluth as well that we work with and contract with. Typically, we utilize those facilities for offenders that are releasing on work release. On any given day, there are about 220 state offenders who are releasing early through the work release program, and they will go to the adult halfway houses or county jails that we contract with to house them until they reach their supervised release date. And then we also utilize the halfway houses. There are some specific ones that we contract with for helping us transition those high-risk predatory offenders out the door from prison so that we have additional eyes on and additional supervision of those individuals as they're transitioning and trying to find a residence in the community. We provide outpatient sex offender treatment statewide through grants that we have through about 20 community-based providers so that offenders who are releasing from prison who still need sex offender treatment have an option to receive that treatment in the community, again, through these community providers. And essentially, we have pretty much every area of the state covered. It's difficult in the rural areas to find providers, but we've been able to do that with our community partners in providing these services. We partner with Department of Economic Development, DEED, at two metro workforce centers to provide what's known as the O4C, or the Opportunities for Change program. That was some funding that was provided from the legislature a couple sessions ago that allowed us to develop these two what we call hub centers, one in Hennepin, one in Ramsey in the metro area. And it assists our high-risk offenders who are releasing from prison with opportunities for employment, housing supports, mentoring, cognitive behavioral programming, and case management. And we utilize VOA Amicus for some of the mentoring programming. We utilize Asian Media Resources over in Minneapolis for some of the COG programming. And then we work with DEED, who provides two employment navigators to recruit employers who are willing to hire individuals who are releasing from prison. And then we also collaborate with community stakeholders to facilitate transition coalitions. These are located in five areas around the state, made up of large networks of local providers for chemical dependency, religious resources, faith-based communities, housing resources, employment resources around the state, who come together and work with the agents in those regions to help provide these programs and services while individuals are under supervision, to help them succeed and move on with their lives once they're released from prison. I do have to apologize for these last couple slides here real quickly. The next one, it says DOC release violator admissions over time. This is incorrectly labeled. You might notice the ink is still a little wet, so I wasn't able to proof it before we got here. But this is actually, this slide, if you want to jot down on the top, this is actually our probation violator admissions to prison. So as you can see, over time from 2014 to 2018, for the first 4 years of this, the probation violators being admitted to prison was relatively consistent, around 2,000 roughly offenders who were violated on probation and their sentence executed and sent to prison. We had an incredible drop, something that we haven't seen for some time, from 2017 to 2018, where probation violator admissions dropped to 1,398. It's important to note that this is by calendar year data, not fiscal year data.
Chair and committee members, if I could just say, I think this is a positive trend line. Obviously, it's certainly a priority, and I think it reflects the commitment, I think, of all the partners across the system to try and find ways to address those people that are struggling on probation, to find ways to mediate and address those in the community, as opposed to sending them into our prisons.
The next slide, again, this is, it's titled Annual Revocation Admissions. These are release violators, what we commonly refer to as our RVs. And as you can see, we've had an upward trend over several years, over the last 10 years, with release violator admissions to prison. And this, again, is calendar year data. In the last year, between 17 and 18, we saw about a 400 offender drop in our release violator admissions to prison.
I've had three or four people raise their hands. I'd like to get the presentation finished, and we've got about 4 minutes.
Sure. So real quickly, priorities based on feedback and input. I think this is...
So I just would wrap this up by just saying, over the course of the last several weeks, since I've been in this role, it has been, I've been out and about talking to folks, stakeholders on a variety of fronts, both the community side as well as offenders in our prisons, some on supervision, as well as certainly a lot of our staff. We know, as Representative Chair Considine kind of pointed out, that without safety, we can do nothing. And that's a basic human need. We recognize that reality, and that is kind of our first focus. We need to stabilize on that front so that we can make sure that we do a good job by way of programming, which is the second point. That ultimately, in recognition of the fact that these folks are coming back to our communities, are going to be our neighbors in many cases, we need to prioritize the opportunities for change while they're in our facilities or under our supervision. Third, we have to continue to support our agents and the folks that are doing criminal justice work as something that I think is not seen as frequently. Certainly, law enforcement was far more visible, and yet ultimately, I think corrections does play a key and critical role in community safety going forward. And then finally, we can't do this alone, and we all know this, that we need in government, we need in the Department of Corrections to collaborate across the full spectrum to prevent people from accessing and entering the system in the first place, and then ultimately developing stronger connected partnerships with education, business, to increase the successful reintegration of those returning home to our communities. And again, all that in light of with safety. So that's our presentation. We thank you for letting us do that. And we would stand for any questions if there's time.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. We got about a minute, and there are four reps, and I'm going to apologize to Representative Long, Representative Moeller, Representative Miller, and Representative Johnson. Luckily, it's two Democrats and two Republicans, so I don't feel too bad about it. Because I want to make one comment. Sorry, I'm chair. And that is, going back to Representative Zerwas and the 90-day Step Brown program, I just feel it would be remiss if I did not mention that I was in Oak Park Heights in June, and they were implementing it correctly, and it was starting to get buy-in, and then the custody staff. So it was actually being implemented and working at Oak Park Heights. I'm not sure about the other ones. I just have no knowledge, but that was. And I saw the warden from Oak Park Heights, and she's doing a good job, so I felt like I needed to say that. And son of a gun, it's now 2:15. We are adjourned.